Hey everyone, and welcome to this latest edition of the Snake Oilers podcast. I'm Patrick Gray. This isn't the weekly show. This is the podcast from Risky.Biz where vendors explain their tech. The original idea behind these shows was vendors would come on the show and aggressively pitch their products. But you know what? What they mostly want to do is actually explain what their technology does so people out there in listener land actually know what they do. Now, this is a commercial podcast. All vendors who you're going to hear from did pay to participate. But that said, I think you'll really enjoy this edition of the show. You'll just find out more about what our collection of vendor friends are actually doing. And they really, hand on heart, really actually do have some interesting stuff to say. We do these podcasts four times a year. If you're a vendor and you are interested in participating in our next one, do email sales@risky.biz. So, I have broken this latest special into two parts. In this edition, we're going to hear from CrowdStrike, Replicated, and Attack IQ. On Monday next week, I'll be posting part two with Remediant and Yubico, the makers of YubiKeys. Those two companies both make authentication technology, which is why I decided to sort of split them out on their own. But yeah, in this part, CrowdStrike are going to tell us why they think their EDR and AV solution is the best. A lot of you probably didn't even know CrowdStrike does AV now. They've got a pretty compelling endpoint detection and response pitch plus AV. Attack IQ will pitch its software as a more affordable and much more effective alternative to regular red teaming. They are, of course, the makers of attack simulation software. But we're going to start off this part with a company called Replicated. And I actually found this interview really, really interesting. They're the wild card in this edition. Mostly, I guess, because they're here with us trying to sell this stuff to security vendors, not CISOs and users. Really what they do is they take cloud services and turn them into on-prem software, or at least private cloud software. And for some organizations, that's a thing that they really need. And Replicated's business, as a result, is booming. They've built a really nifty bunch of tools for de-cloudifying cloud services. Now, software is increasingly being offered under a SaaS model, but you know, some people still need it to be on-prem. Now, because most SaaS vendors use a DevOps approach to their products, taking that software and making it portable is actually pretty easy if you know how to do it and you've already done it once. And Replicated has done it a bunch of times. You know, and this is because it's all de facto standardized because it's built using the same fundamental building blocks. Replicated's founder, Grant Miller, joined me to discuss.
I think that there's a lot of preconceived notions about like on-prem software and that sort of being a, you know, kind of legacy technology. And what we like to talk about is why this is the next generation of kind of all enterprise software, right? And it's merging sort of, you know, this, the idea that enterprises are moving to the cloud and are using infrastructure as a service with the idea that like modern SaaS applications are sort of developed and deployed in a way that's totally reproducible and automated and sort of leveraging technologies like Docker and Kubernetes and basically creating this, like just shifting all of the ground upon which traditional enterprise software was based.
Well, I mean, this makes sense, right? Because when you look at these, you know, cloud software solutions, they're all running on some pretty generic technology. So, you know, extending their service into your own, God, I'm not going to say your own cloud because it's not that, but using the same tools to spin it up internally shouldn't actually be too hard. If anything, we're just sort of standardizing when it comes to on-prem and what you're doing, it's sort of seeking to standardize on-prem deployment, right?
Yeah, exactly. But on-prem isn't just like, you know, some data center that, you know, a big bank is running, but on-prem is really like an Amazon VPC, just that the enterprise controls, you know, that's not controlled by the SaaS company, right?
Yeah, yeah. So you can use your own, you can use your own Amazon account to do it, right?
Exactly, right? And so it really comes down to the idea that a lot of the alternatives to data secrecy and security just leave like aren't perfect, right? And ultimately, you know, it's things like enterprise key management or fully homomorphic encryption just don't actually deliver on sort of this zero trust, give your data to a SaaS company, let them host it all, but they can never discover it, right? If you're using those technologies, there's some amount of trust that either the enterprise SaaS company won't be keeping that key somewhere or pushing out unencrypted data into a log file. And so there's sort of this gap where it's like enterprises want security, but they also want modern applications. And we try to just say, look, like everything has changed in the last like 5 or 6 years. So now you can really have both like a full private instance of an application that you don't have to manage and maintain because it's totally automated in the way that it's delivered to every single private instance, wherever that might reside.
Now, this is interesting, right? Because most companies will opt for a cloud service because they are tremendously convenient. Now, the problems that you're seeking to solve with this are sort of those higher order problems that tend to apply to larger companies or companies in heavily regulated environments. Is that where your customers are, like big enterprise and regulated environments? Because I'm really curious about that.
Our customers, our direct customers, are actually the SaaS vendors, right? So it's the vendors in the world choose the replicated platform to power the enterprise version of their product. The end customers end up being, we have about a third of the Fortune 100 who are actively running applications through the replicated platform. But it's also not just the Fortune 100, right? There's a lot of these sort of like Silicon Valley unicorns that are running applications through us as well. So if you look at someone like Coinbase, right, who isn't necessarily highly regulated, but they value data privacy and secrecy, quite highly because they're basically a modern bank, right? They prefer to use private instances of applications versus the multi-tenant SaaS application that you would think that they would be using, right?
Mm-mm.
So
how do you go about actually taking a cloud service? Like say I'm a vendor, I'm operating some sort of cloud delivered service. How do I then, work with you to turn it into a, replicated instance that people can run privately?
Yes. So most modern SaaS applications have already taken the sort of initial steps toward being able to do this, right? And those initial steps are really about automation and reproducibility. So when you think about the idea that like DevOps sort of bakes all of the application deployment and management into the development effort, what that does, it means that they can spin up private environments anywhere, right? So generally they use this in order to create a dev environment or a stage environment or give every developer their own environment, right? They have a manifest that describes the application completely, all the different components, what ports are supposed to be opened, how it's all sequenced together. And that's the first step, right? You have to be embracing things like Docker and Kubernetes and sort of the idea that automation is an important part of how you're going to deliver your application in the cloud.
I'm guessing most of them already do that though, right? Because that's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah, I think that most modern SaaS applications do. When you look at folks like Workday or Salesforce, these are kind of these legacy SaaS applications that are, have kind of evaluated these technologies, but generally, your Salesforce instance is like in their big data center and they have to like, it's this huge pain in the butt to actually manage and deploy a Salesforce app, right? If you talk to anybody that's ever worked in the production there, it's like their whole process is a kind of a shit show.
Yeah, right. I didn't know that, but that's interesting. Go on.
Modern SaaS applications, right? They do this sort of DevOps and they do automation and they think about the idea that no one should ever be SSHing into a production database, right? You apply updates through migration scripts and you use these sort of standard tools so that you have a reliable, production instance. And those same automation scripts and that same automation that you're using to manage your cloud application can actually run in any environment, right? So that's the idea, is that you leverage that same manifest to then update a private instance when it's deployed into a large enterprise, into their on-prem data center or their VPC.
No, look, this makes total sense. I should point out too that this isn't exclusively, a security SaaS, brought on-prem thing. I mean, you only have one security client so far, if I'm correct, and that's Tenable, right?
Yeah, we don't have a ton of security vendors on the platform yet. I think that it's an area where we're seeing more and more adoption. I think security vendors they're pushed up against, you know, the security teams at these IT orgs. And so they see requests for enterprise on-prem versions of their product. And most of the time, if they're a modern SaaS application, they just tell them no, right? But with Replicated, as long as they're thinking about automation and reproducibility and sort of modern application architecture, they can say yes, and they can start to deliver those enterprise versions without a huge amount of overhead, right?
Basically, well, is one of the sticking points that they're worried about risking their IP by pushing out their code into, you know, an environment that they don't control?
I mean, that's an interesting point. If you think about like how GitHub solves that, right? So GitHub delivers GitHub Enterprise. It's about half of their revenue comes from GitHub Enterprise versus GitHub.com. And they do things like, you know, use an encoder. They use Ruby encoder to obfuscate the code, right? And so like anytime you do deliver your software somewhere, there is an opportunity for the enterprise to reverse engineer it, just like you could reverse engineer an operating system that you have. But ultimately, I think most of our vendors just think about the fact that when they're delivering a license to an enterprise customer, there's contractual obligations for them not to try to discover the source code. You know, and generally, these large enterprises aren't interested in discovering and sort of stealing your IP out of your source code. That's not why they're buying from you. So
which types of vendors are you keen on hearing from, particularly in the security space where we have, you know, so many listeners?
We're just looking for any vendor that has had this request from a large enterprise and they're interested in a way to solve it and they want to have it solved faster. So I think when you think about time to market, like Replicated, we've solved all the problems and all the corner cases and edge cases around delivering these enterprise versions. And then we also add in a whole bunch of enterprise functionality, right? So when you're deploying on-prem, your enterprise customers are probably going to want to do user management with LDAP and Active Directory. And Replicated helps you solve that, you know, in a matter of hours versus a matter of, you know, weeks or months. We do similar features around providing extensive audit log integration so that your end customer can take all the activity from the app and put it into their SIM. We have functionality around advanced reporting so you can provide dashboards and reports that you wouldn't provide to your cloud customers around utilization. And there's even components in there for change management in terms of viewing release notes, doing snapshots and restore processes as you update the application. We just try to solve all those problems that enterprises are going to push on you once you start delivering an on-prem version of the product.
Grant Miller, thank you very much for joining us to talk about Replicated.
Great, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
That was Grant Miller, a founder of Replicated. Do check them out at replicated.com to learn more, especially, yeah, if you're a vendor, like, you want to know what they're doing. The funny thing is I've mentioned them to a couple of other risky business sponsors and, you know, they're always pretty interested. They always reach for the pen when I start talking about what they're doing. Replicated.com. Okay, let's get into our next interview now with Attack IQ's founder, Stefan Chanet. He's going to tell you why you should stop spending all your money on red teaming and get serious about attack simulation. I really, really, really genuinely dig what these guys do. And it's funny because I saw Stefan in Las Vegas and I wound up actually jumping in when he was pitching a customer at his booth. So Attack IQ is an attack simulation company. We also did a Soapbox podcast with these guys not so long ago. That runs for about 40 minutes. So if you find this interesting, there is more Risky Biz content, you know, dealing with Attack IQ. But yeah, they do attack simulation. The idea being they load an agent onto your systems that's capable of doing things like, say, generating funny traffic, scanning the network, dropping unsigned files onto the disk, or loading funny stuff into the memory. It's basically a Swiss Army agent that you put on your boxes. And before you freak out, yes, you can offline sign the attack scenario scripts that these things swallow, you know, as a security measure. There's more detail on that in the Soapbox recording. But the idea is you can use the attack scenarios Attack IQ has developed as a way to measure the effectiveness of your security controls. Attack IQ even plugs into your security kit so it can measure, like, out of 5 stars, the effectiveness of each control as deployed. It's a very boardroom-friendly report that this thing will actually spit out. It's a great feedback mechanism. I spoke to a friend actually recently from another company who was working with a client who was trialing Attack IQ, and they generated a bunch of attack behavior on their network and they didn't hear anything from their MSSP, right? So now they have a report that they can use to beat the MSSP over the head with. Anyway, here's Stefan Chanet of Attack IQ telling you why you should consider attack simulation as a really good alternative to things like red teaming exercises.
Red teaming exercises are something that happen potentially quarterly, very costly, it's hard to repeat. It's hard to make red teaming exercises consistent. It's hard to actually communicate with the rest of the business units and allow them to repeat the exercises to find those same weaknesses. You need a platform that actually is able to, from a feedback perspective, have the red team demonstrate all the weaknesses and, you know, doing crazy things with ADB debug ports and Android devices, and then allow the infrastructure team and the C-suite to actually understand why that's a risk to the business. So translation and repeatability are huge.
It makes answering questions very easy, right? Because, you know, for people who don't know, you know, you script these attack scenarios. Now, say there's some mad outbreak sweeping through the world, you can pretty much run a simulation against similar events and then be able to have that answer for your board. You can say, yeah, look, this is what would happen if we were confronted by this type of scenario, and here's how much it would cost to remediate it, because we can very narrowly define the problem. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, everything when you're talking about security, amongst us technologists and those that are in the InfoSec field, hate to say it, but it's all about business risk, right? And so when the board's talking to the CISO or to the security team, they're talking about business risk, and then they're allowing a certain amount of investment into technologies that's minimizing that risk. And so how do you then go demonstrate through a series of exercises that you're actually putting the right investment into EDR, into firewalls, into web filters to minimize that risk? You have to be able to demonstrate that.
Now, something that you just told me before we started recording this interview that I think is, you know, considering we're in a pitch podcast, essentially, right? I think it's a pretty compelling pitch, which is you say you can do a paid pilot of your software across an enterprise for, you know, like a competitive cost against a single red team exercise. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a new space, right? And we're not ignorant to that fact. We want to make, you know, half the time I come into meetings and everyone, you know, looks around the board and there's the CIO, the CISO, the head of the red team, the pen testing team, infrastructure, engineering. Everybody's like, well, we've been talking about this for 6 months. We actually had no idea there was a vendor or solution or technology that could do anything close to this. So our goal is to introduce this into your network, into your infrastructure, and allow you to see the value yourself at a nominal cost.
Now, I'm really curious to actually get you to walk us through one of these feedback loops that you've observed. You know, you've got a bunch of clients using this like enterprise-wide on every single machine, basically in their network, and you can actually run through these scenarios, and, you know, weaknesses or blind spots become very apparent very quickly. But I want you to walk us through what a typical exercise using your software looks like, because I think that would be interesting.
Yeah. So the way that I like to think of it, and there's tons of different anecdotes and different ways depending on, you know.
Well, I'm mostly interested in an anecdote. You know what I mean? I'm interested in, you know, we deployed at company X and then they found out that their control for this was terrible and got rid of it. But I'm just curious to break it down into something quite tangible.
Yeah, sure. So the way I look at it is almost from a QA mentality. Sometimes unit testing or regression testing. Let's take a unit test, right? You have one assumption. I remember there's a company of ours that's a customer. They were actually mentioned in the APT1 report, you know, and they had a number of different discussions about DNS security. Is the channels and, you know, covert communications of malware over DNS an issue for us? What do we have in place? It was a discussion. And I think that's one of the issues in security. In so many cases, you know, change control, these discussions take forever before action and proper, you know, restrictions are put in place, because everybody's an expert, right? And maybe they're all right, but it takes forever to actually act upon it. So they were a customer. And in this case, what they did is they went and ran across 50 project sites, the scenarios in the Attack IQ platform related to communicating through DNS to the external internet. And in doing that, understood all the weaknesses, going, well, they came back with a data report as opposed to just this opinion where they're weak, saying that DNS as a means of communication from the internal intranet to the external internet is an issue. It's a weakness. The data is, you can't argue with the data. And so at that point, decisions were made to restrict communications to third-party DNS servers. And guess what happened? As soon as they did that, they were able to detect that they, in fact, had malware inside of their network, and it was communicating over DNS, something that they would have never realized had they not found it, you know, and tested, made sure there was a weakness, and then put restrictions in place, and then realized through other means, through other software, that they actually had a problem.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? And I reckon I'm just guessing that everyone at Attack IQ actually has a fair bit of fun coming up with these like exfil modules, right? Because I'd imagine, do you have multiple techniques for testing data exfiltration over DNS? Do you have like one that's subtle and one that's noisy? Are you always sort of thinking about more sneaky ways to try to sneak past your client's detection technology?
Yeah, I mean, yes, but at the same time, you know, the fact is we can get around any technology, right? Bypassing security technology restrictions, that's easy. So what we try to do is focus on what's realistic, what's actually happening in the wild, what's real world, why are technologies in place, what are their capabilities, as opposed to kind of fear-mongering, trying to introduce new techniques that really aren't in the
wild. That point out that everything fails, right? Yeah, that right, sort of security nihilism approach. And you know, you come up with a module that exfils data by posting comments on Britney Spears' Instagram or something, and you say, aha!
Sure, right? Or, you, I mean, there's been tons of, you know, use of covert communications over Twitter. So if it's realistic, it's realistic. And so, yeah, we have for DNS, you know, DNS over A records, null records, text records, you know, and then turning the knob to make it more aggressive, less, you know, aggressive, very much from a red team mentality perspective, until the point going, well, if I continue to this, turn this knob, when do I start to detect this type of behavior in my network? And at that point, the infrastructure team can understand their ability, at what level would they be able to detect and pick up anomalous behavior? Is it very subtle? Or is it when it's just blasting, you know, port scans left and right?
And you're going to get to a point in your tuning as well, I'm guessing, that, you know, you're spotting, you might be spotting the exfil, but now you've got a false positives problem. And then that's a, that might be something for the SIEM people to figure out, right? So it just gives you, it you know, what I think about Attack IQ is it's, the first step to solving a problem is to be able to narrowly identify it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, years ago when I was truly doing a lot more thought leadership of the space and pitching, and I'm still doing that today, but you know, if you can't measure it, you can't improve it. That's what I would say all the time. Right. And I say, well, you know, you've put this in place. Excellent. How do you know that it's working? How are you measuring the capabilities? Because if you're not, you're just buying solutions and you're just putting more processes and hiring more people just because. But if you didn't have a problem that you didn't measure and know that you had, then how are you improving it? You know, Attack IQ focuses on inside in, inside out. So the exfil scenarios, those are always a concern. You know, the looking at the perimeter from the inside in and the inside out, and any communications happening from command and control traffic to exfiltration of data. But you know, 80% of Windows attacks are still, you know, very successful in use of pass the hash. You know, Kerber's golden ticket, you know, common techniques where it's the same patterns again and again and again. So as much as it's fun to come up with these obscure techniques, we still, you know, focus on.
Yeah, you want to knock off the workaday stuff, right? Because that's how people rack up wins. But look, we've got a very short time left, but I want to ask you, you've spoken about exfil as one scenario that has been very helpful to a specific client, but you know, what you do is a lot bigger than that. Can you perhaps give us another anecdote that is similar, but involving a different type of threat? Because I think that would be valuable for the listeners.
Absolutely. So this was a public case. I remember Brian Krebs writing about the case there was an intrusion at Intuit where a member of the security team had installed malware and listened and captured voice traffic of something that that person really didn't believe was ethically correct, you know, exfiltrated that data, shared it with Brian Krebs and others that wrote about it. You know, it was under kind of the whistleblower clause that this person was falling under. Regardless, we got a lot of calls and a lot of emails requesting scenarios that would allow or customers to record traffic on their devices and determine, well, if there was recording of our data and it was being exfiltrated, would we notice it? Would if the microphone actually started turning on and exfiltration of that data in chunks started getting sent off to, you know, different parts of the country or, you know, whether it be, you know, outside of the US or inside of the US, is that something that they would notice? And many thought that they would, but had no ability to test it. So that's, you know, one example. And the other examples are obviously cases where we're talking about complete end-to-end, you know, getting access to a machine, dumping, you know, credentials at that point, using those credentials to start a remote service on an adjacent machine after scanning it, scanning for further files, exfiltrating those files. And we can talk about, you know, 5 to 10 phases all along the way, testing the security controls, their ability to detect and prevent, which Attack IQ is looking at the end-to-end. We're not only creating the traffic patterns that measures and replicates the attackers, we're actually measuring and monitoring the security tools at the same time. And that's something, if you go hire a red team or a pen testing firm, they can't do both. They can't be on both sides of the fence. They can go create all this traffic, but they're not hooked into all the technologies end-to-end, determining, well, process-wise, did it end up in X, you know, EDR vendor, end up in your SIM, and then get, you know, orchestrated through some IR orchestration platform? We can actually measure that whole end-to-end process while generating all this traffic. So even more advanced at a much more reasonable cost than, say, a consulting firm trying to do this, but we're trying to put this in the hands of every single security team for that feedback loop to discuss with the board and be able to describe it in their language and describe it to other business units in their language, doing something quite technical, all about minimization of risk. That's what we're all about.
Stefan Chanet, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Stefan Chanet of Attack IQ there. And really, if you are a company that spends money on EDR, you know, antivirus, SIEM, and all of that good stuff, if you've got a fairly mature security program, why not go and just pilot this tech, this Attack IQ, attack simulation tech, to make sure all of that stuff is actually working properly? It is a really worthwhile thing to do. Do check out Attack IQ at attackiq.com. So it is time for our chat with CrowdStrike now. There is no more competitive segment in the InfoSec industry than the desktop security space. And one thing that started happening is all of the endpoint detection and response vendors out there are now becoming antivirus vendors as well. And all of the AV vendors out there are trying to become EDR vendors. And it is shaking things up. We used to live in a McAfee, Symantec, and Trend Micro world, but we're increasingly and rapidly transitioning to the CrowdStrike, Cylance, and Carbon Black world. Our next guest is the manager of security engineering for CrowdStrike, a vendor that's doing genuinely interesting things with its endpoint security software. They started out as an enterprise detection and response vendor, but as of about a year ago, they're also an AV company, which a lot of people just don't know yet. Their idea is to do the whole lot in one lightweight client. Now, a lot of people might say, hey, I don't have a team that can manage an EDR product. Well, CrowdStrike has a bit of an advantage here. You'll often hear me talk about Splunk syndrome. Companies buy products that they don't actually have the time or the expertise to monitor. CrowdStrike says its hybrid sort of product services model mitigates this somewhat. Where most legacy AV companies throw analyst hours at pulling apart binary samples, CrowdStrike throws analyst hours at analyzing customer logs in aggregate. It means that they can identify new attacker behaviors that they can then turn into indicators of attack and throw at your historical logs. Andrew Munchback of CrowdStrike joined me for this interview, and I asked him simply why he thinks people should buy CrowdStrike instead of competing solutions. Here's what he said.
CrowdStrike kind of came to market as an EDR platform, so we're really concerned about, you know, the unknown and the unknowable, right? Collect all the data, and then you can proactively search and parse that data. That was about 5 years ago, but we've come a long way since then. We're kind of a full spectrum vendor. So, you know, just so everyone's clear, CrowdStrike is a company. We were in Irvine, California, and we do three real things. We have three sort of products. We have an EDR product, a next-gen AV product, so we have an endpoint solution. We have an intelligence product, so an intelligence feed and finished intelligence that you can purchase. And then we have a services team that does proactive and reactive IR services.
As I understand it, you know, as you mentioned, right, CrowdStrike did start off as an EDR vendor, but it was only quite recently that you sort of jumped onto the AV side of things as well to offer more of a complete package. If I understand it correctly, that's been very good for business.
Yeah, it has. You know, it's always nice. EDR is a great solution, right? But it's always nice when you can displace a technology. I think, you know, anyone listening to the podcast will know if you have to in-house, or if you're procuring some technology, if you can offset that with something else, right? Not buy a thing you were buying. That's always, you know, always a little bit more palatable sometimes than just bringing in a new technology with new spend. So it has, and it really kind of rounds out what we're trying to do with coverage, right? So I think we started with the hard stuff first, right? Endpoint detection and response, you know, having that rich data set. So when you get new information about an attack, right? So you know that a domain name or an IP address or a command line or a specific, you know, string of processes is malicious, not only being able to find that from that point moving forward, but also being able to look back retrospectively and say, hey, has this happened in the past? I think the industry, you know, the dwell time for an attacker in the industry is still over 125 days, right? Which is a long time. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to smash that down to minutes or hours at worst, right? And we do that with a bunch of different techniques. So the thing about our endpoint technology that really makes it stand out is we're not married to one phase of the kill chain or one protection mechanism. So we do, we certainly do, you know, people will call it, you know, next gen AV. You know, I hate the term next gen, but, you know, we have a machine learning based algorithm, right? It's about 12 megabytes. It doesn't require signature updates. That actually sits on your endpoint. And by the way, our whole endpoint software is 18 megabytes in size. So it's very light, you know, on system resources. That's looking for stuff pre-execution, right? We're looking for things that we either know or you know, it's a repackaged piece of crap, or it's a piece of crap we know about, right? Things we've seen before. You train it against an inordinately large data set, right? You expose it to billions and billions of bad files, and you train it and say, these are what bad files look like. So if you see, you know, once you train it against Locky, right, or one of the very first variants of ransomware, when it sees NotPetya, you know, that kind of looks very similar. We don't have to know about that to know that that thing is bad, right? It's going to kind of weaponize the same way.
Everyone's doing machine learning enabled everything these days, right? It's just become the accepted approach.
Yeah, it really has. And it's, consumers are touching machine learning, right? Like sort of the democratization, if you will, of machine learning, right? You're touching it if you're using Facebook Messenger, if you're using Siri on your iPhone, right? You're touching these technologies in a way where, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, you would have only if you were, you know, sort of in an advanced lab or in a research environment. So it's pretty cool. So it really is becoming the standard, but it's also much more effective than some of the traditional methods. You know, we don't marry ourselves to that. We think machine learning is a feature. It's not a product, right? You don't sell that. It's how it behaves. So, you know, with our endpoint technology, we have machine learning, we have exploit mitigation, we have these things we call indicators of attack, which you can think of like behavioral patterns. So if you think of a good binary that you're not going to block with machine learning, like on a Windows system, say PowerShell, right? That's going to be allowed to run every time because, you know, PowerShell is a good binary signed by Microsoft, should be allowed to run. You need it to administer a Windows system. But if further down the kill chain that weaponizes, right, you still want to be able to take action. So we have the ability to terminate threads or fire alerts depending on the policy you set up. So, you know, think about the situation of self-disclosed credentials, right? If, you know, I'm an employee of Risky Business and I use my Risky Business email address and I use the same password on LinkedIn, and then LinkedIn gets breached, right? When would that ever happen? There's a straight line directly to my corporate network, right? So I can just log in, right? I don't really even have to use malware. So, you know, we're trying to move beyond just the thinking of, you know, this is the one thing we do. We're gonna do it really well. And, you know, think of the kill chain as a complete life cycle and try to manage that, right? Pre-execution, post-execution, lateral movement, privilege escalation, all the good stuff.
So I want to talk about how all of the bits of CrowdStrike actually fit together, because I do think that's interesting. But before I do that, let's go back to something you said earlier, which is that, you know, it's very hard to, say, get a network group or, you know, a desktop group to approve another agent, right? So, you know, your experience going to market when you can actually displace another AV vendor has made, you know, actually getting rolled out a lot easier. It does seem like EDR and AV are absolutely going to converge. We've seen Cylance take some early steps into EDR. I'm not quite sure where they're going with that. You know, we've seen FireEye kind of try to do that. And, you know, I don't think they're getting much love from the market for their desktop software, which is, you know, from the Mandiant days. So, I mean, that really kind of leaves one competitor who's doing most of what you're doing, which is Carbon Black, right? So why don't you tell me why you and not Carbon Black? Because I want to hear what you feel your relative strengths are against Carbon Black. You know, when we're talking about a full AV and EDR solution.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple, right? I mean, yeah, and you kind of have to go back, right? I mean, Carbon Black was Bit9, right? Bit9 bought Carbon Black, and then they had two agents. Then Bit9 renamed themselves Carbon Black. Then Carbon Black bought Confer. Now there's three agents, right? And they're working to converge, but they seem to be going out and acquiring these pieces and then trying to smash them together. CrowdStrike sort of has had this vision from the very beginning, right? We have one sensor. We can do a bunch of different things with it. And the way our platform's architected is also a huge differentiator. So we're set up more like Gmail, not like a hosted service. So we're a cloud provider, but we're not running a server in the cloud with a copy of our software and we give you access to that server, right? It's set up more like Gmail, right? There's a Kafka front end, there's a data processing backplane, and it scales, you know, linearly and almost infinitely to any size. We have customers with, you know, 800,000 endpoints. We have customers with 1,000 endpoints, right? It doesn't matter because of the way our architecture is set up. And we also have this thing on the back end we call the Threat Graph, which is an Elasticsearch graph database. And that allows us to do all sorts of cool stuff. So on top of our platform, I kind of mentioned we're not married to one thing. Another differentiator for CrowdStrike is we have a managed hunting team. We call them Overwatch. So that sits behind.
Now, this
product,
is the bit,
right?
That I was going to get to, right? Because I find it very interesting that you've got, it's almost like a hybrid model, but you know, a lot of these companies that have, you know, EDR solutions, they're sort of buying them unnecessarily because they don't have the people who are required to actually staff them and look at the data. I call that the Splunk syndrome, actually. But with CrowdStrike, you actually have your own staff who just sort of look at this data in aggregate and use it to sort of improve. You find more IOCs and whatever, and then feed them back into the product. But you do actually have, yeah, just that dedicated sort of search team, not just looking at binaries, which is where a lot of the AV companies sort of fall down. They got huge teams looking at binaries. You're looking for more than just binaries.
Yeah, they're really hunting humans. So the platform does a great job on its own with some of the automated detections, sussing out binaries and behaviors and files at machine speed. But when there's a human interacting with a keyboard, humans are really random. And, you know, you can talk to anyone who's familiar with machine learning. It's really hard to teach an algorithm what a human might do because it's, you know, it's completely arbitrary. It's random. There might be a long time delta or, you know, the techniques might change. So they're actually looking for hands-on keyboard activity within our customer environment, but they can also do things like retrospective searching, right? So once, you know, we see an adversary on one of our customers' network, we're observing that tradecraft and we consider that tradecraft burned. So then we'll not only say, hey, is this happening anywhere else, but has this happened in the past? Again, we're trying to take that dwell time, which is, you know, currently very large, and we're trying to smash it down so it's very small. You know, we're trying to raise the cost for an adversary to be on your network and really, you know, just provide extra value to our customers with the managed hunt team. So, I mean, certainly the way the platform's architected, certainly the managed hunt team, I mean, the fact that we're not married to one part of the kill chain, you know, we have our intelligence indicators are in there. We have, you know, SANS just voted us the best intelligence product of 2017, I think. And those indicators are in there as well. We focus pretty heavily on nation state, e-crime, hacktivists, and terrorist groups. So you get all that with CrowdStrike. It's, you know, it's a complete solution. Not to mention that we have a services team that uses our product. So if you really get yourself in a pickle, we can helicopter people in and provide some assistance.
All right, Andrew Munchbeck, thank you very much for joining us on the show to talk about why you feel CrowdStrike is the best EDR and AV solution.
Thanks, Patrick. I enjoyed talking with you.
That was Andrew Munchbeck of CrowdStrike there, and you can check them out at crowdstrike.com. And that's it for part one of our Snake Oilers special. I'll be back in the weekly show on Wednesday afternoon, Australia time. And I'll likely push out part two of this Snake Oilers special early next week. I hope you enjoyed this. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.